From WLVR Bethlehem and Lehigh University, this is the show that gets you behind the real lives of Lehigh faculty. This is Prof Talk.
Hi, welcome to the first ever video Prof Talks, very special edition. We are here with Professor Diley. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves?
I was born and raised in Silver Spring, Maryland. Mm-hmm. Studied economics as an undergraduate at the University of Maryland, College Park. Went to graduate school at Harvard. Took my first job at Texas A&M University in Texas, Bryan College Station, Texas. And then eventually moved back east, where I wanted to be, to Bethlehem, to Lehigh University. That was in 1991. Wow. So, and I've been here since then.
Have you ever been to the Digital Media Studio?
I have, because this semester I am teaching a large lecture, Eco One. Mm-hmm. It's not what I usually do because I used to do it quite a while ago, maybe 14, 15 years ago was the last time I did it. But this semester the economics department had some unexpected leaves, and so we were shuffling around tasks, and I agreed to do it. It's been quite an interesting ride, but at any rate, teaching the large lecture, I need a microphone.
Yeah.
And I came here. They were very helpful and gave me the microphone that I use. It's a wireless thing.
Yeah. Okay. And why did you choose Lehigh to come back to teach to?
Well, the economics profession has this, as you might imagine, very well-organized job market. Every December and early January. So all through the fall, you're looking at the job openings for Economist magazine.
Yeah.
And Lehigh was one of the schools I applied to. I was interested in coming back to the East Coast, as I said. And it had a very attractive advertisement, and I interviewed for the job and eventually got it. I was happy.
I can imagine. It's a great school.
It is a very good school. And the department is very nice. The colleagues have been great.
Okay. How did you get into economics? Why did you choose economics?
When I first went to college, I was a physics major. I was checking that out. And I felt like I wasn't getting it after the first semester or so, so I started casting around. I took, computer science and accounting and economics and a bunch of different things. And the economics intrigued me, and I ended up sticking with it and choosing that as my undergraduate major.
That answers my question. What was your major in college? Economics, of course. What were some of the jobs you've had before you were a teacher?
I really haven't had any other types of jobs. I went to undergraduate, I went to graduate, and then I started teaching right away. In the course of my career, there was one year when I went off and I was a visiting scholar at the Federal Reserve Bank in Cleveland, where basically I just did research. And then there were a couple of years in the very late 90s where I was on leave from Lehigh to go and work for the National Science Foundation.
Ooh.
One of the things that the National Science Foundation does, one of its programs, is to fund economic research. And they hire what they call rotators, people coming in from the academic world, to look at all the different proposals and kind of organize the review of the proposals by many scholars, many economic scholars in the case of our program, and in the end figure out which of the proposals should be funded. And so that was rather interesting. A break. That was 2 years I was away doing that.
And why the National Science Foundation? And again, would you say that the National Science Foundation also focuses on the social sciences as well as, I want to say, the natural sciences?
It does to some extent. The National Science Foundation has 9 directorates, and one of them is behavioral and social sciences. Mm-hmm. So economics is one of the biggest programs there, but they also have small programs in political science, a bigger one in psychology. Mm-hmm. There's some, what else was there? Law, geography, neuroscience, I think. or maybe they called it cognitive science, I can't remember really. But there was a directorate that was social and behavioral science. But most of the money goes to the different natural sciences, which seems reasonable to me, basically.
Well, you think it would go to the economists because they wouldn't know what to do with it.
Well.
Okay. And what can you do today with an economics degree? Is it a good field to get into?
I would say it is a good field to get into, but I'll also say it's a little scarier than some things. In some types of majors, it's clearer what you're going to do. So if you study mechanical engineering or if you study accounting, you're studying a particular set of clear skills for a pretty well-defined career path. When you study economics, I think you learn some things that could be a well-defined career path. So, for instance, if you study a lot of macro, you might be very interested in forecasting for firms or associations or for state or federal government. If you're a microeconomist, if you study more the micro, then there's also jobs in public life and in consulting that an economics background is good for. It's just that it's not as defined. You need to work harder and figure out more what you want to do and try to go search for it. More in general, though, I would say that economics training is very good for a wide variety of different types of things. A lot of people that go to law school have an undergraduate degree in economics. If you go to public policy, a degree in economics is extremely useful. Any type of political activity, if you wanted to be an advisor for a political figure, economics training is really going to be helpful because in many ways, a lot of the debate, although I frequently find the debate is not very of a very high standard, everybody's throwing around the terms in terms of economics, and it's easier to understand when they're blowing smoke than when if they really have a good, solid argument.
Which is usual.
Well, it depends, but a lot of times the reasoning is not very persuasive if you really understand the issues.
And why do you think so many people get into economics?
I don't think a lot of people do. I think it's a certain habit of thought or an interest in understanding the macroeconomy, which actually was the first thing that drew me to economics. I thought it was a mysterious thing, and it was a way of ordering the world that I found attractive. And then I ended up going into micro, though, because I think micro is also a set of tools and models that really help you figure out what are good questions to ask in a lot of cases, and what people are ignoring that, you know, maybe they should ignore it, maybe they shouldn't, but at least they should know that they're ignoring it.
Okay. Personally, do you prefer macroeconomics or microeconomics?
Well, I am a microeconomist, but I certainly understand the appeal of macro because that's what first attracted me. And it's been a real challenge this semester to do Eco 1 again because the last time I taught it, the macro economy had just had this incredible run of the 90s where we were having strong growth and low inflation, high employment. I remember saying to my classes at that point, these are the golden years. You'll look back on this and you'll say, these are amazing golden years, and they were. But in a way, it's more interesting now because the problems that the recession has caused, not only in the U.S., but around the world, are interesting. It's a real challenge to figure out how to try to handle some of the problems that exist today.
And why is it such a challenge?
Well, because the challenges are unusual. We we have very little experience of being in kind of a deflationary economy where the interest rates are very, very, very low. Mm-hmm. And where that means monetary policy, which has been the mainstay of economic macro policy for decades now, doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. And turning to fiscal policy is made difficult by the fact that countries have these debt problems, and so they're very reluctant to take on more debt in order to fuel fiscal policy. It will be interesting to see what happens.
But wouldn't these policies overall help these countries that are in a large amount of debt?
Well, it kind of depends on whether people are willing to lend to them. Mm-hmm. I think the U.S. could probably easily increase its debt without too much trouble and invest in infrastructure. And I think I find that a fairly persuasive argument about what we probably should do, probably should have been doing for some time. If you're in Greece, no. I mean, people talk about the U.S., you know, being profligate and not being careful enough about its debt. And the problems are growing. But some countries have been far, far more profligate. And it's very difficult for them now. They've boxed themselves into corners because people will resist lending them money to help them get out of their difficulties. It's going to be a long, hard road.
Yeah. Do you see a pattern of increasing debt in the future or getting better?
I think I see a pattern of increasing debt unless the politicians are willing to come to grips with it. And they so far have said they're not really willing to come to grips with it in any serious kind of a way.
Why do you think so? Why do you think they're unable to address this big issue of impending debt?
Well, it's not impending debt that's the problem. The problem is the debt. While as a percentage of GDP right now it's kind of not increasing too fast, it's going to start increasing faster as the population ages. I think it's hard for politicians because it's a hard problem. You know, there's some uncertainties. If we could get health costs to only increase with the growth of GDP, that would be enormously helpful. If we could plug some tax loopholes and maybe increase taxes in some places, we'll probably have to, and maybe reduce some benefits, we'll probably have to, then we could probably get ourselves into a stable configuration where the debt to GDP ratio stays maybe in the 60 to 70 range or something like that. As long as it stops growing, I think. Because we've had much worse in the past, right?
Yeah.
In World War II, it was like 120% topped out. But then it fell steadily because the economy was growing faster than government spending.
How can we improve the economy right now?
Well, gosh. I'm going to give the same bromides that everybody else is saying. Yeah. I personally would probably go down the road of greater fiscal spending on stuff that helps productivity growth. So borrowing to repair infrastructure, maybe to invest in different types of research, though that sounds a bit self-interested. I would not put economic research at the top of the list, I will say. And, you know, spending more on people's education. And I'm not saying that I think that it's a good idea to give education, college education to people for free, because I don't. I don't think that's fair.
Yeah.
Because that means tax money from everybody would be giving education to some people. But I do think helping more people find better ways to make a living, whether helping them finance community or four-year college, or coming up with other types of more innovative programs where people do things like apprenticeships for more technical jobs that we need. I mean, we always need electricians and welders and plumbers and things like that. And maybe more training in those areas and all the areas I can't even think of. Putting in HVAC systems and this type of thing. Nobody's going to be replacing plumbers with robots anytime soon, as far as I can see, or electricians for that matter.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do need training for those types of jobs, you know, serious training, and maybe making more types of training programs available would be useful. I don't know. It's a real problem for especially young men that don't go to college because the factory jobs that used to really make them able to really earn nice livings are there are many fewer of them available, I think.
Yeah, like the Bethlehem Steel Factory closing down would be a prime example of that.
Yes.
Okay.
You are listening to Prof Talks only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
How do you think economics has changed over the years?
I think it's probably made me more conservative than I otherwise would be. I would say probably more of on the scale for economists, more liberal, but on the scale of arts and sciences faculty, definitely more conservative. You tend to be much more aware of opportunity costs and just costs in general. And so when people say, well, we should send everybody to college for free, I just sit back and I say, that's not a useful suggestion in my mind.
Okay. And how do you think new technology and new media has affected economics?
I would say that new technology in the sense of computer power and better software programs, statistical software programs, has improved econometrics. I would say that more importantly, getting access to data sets, huge data sets, and being able to use them to study different topics. So for instance, the state of Pennsylvania collects information on every inpatient case in Pennsylvania hospitals. So if you could get the data, now they de-identify it, so you can't actually look up your own case of appendicitis or anything in this data. It's all de-identified. But you can look and see how well, say, different hospitals perform in terms of the outcomes of patients. Did they die? Did they were they readmitted? And you can look to see, recently a lot of my work has been looking to see how, say, investments in IT have affected performance and productivity of doctors, how competition, if there's a lot of competition amongst the hospitals, if there's, you know, four or five or six hospitals that are within easy driving distance, do you get better outcomes or worse outcomes? You can tell stories that could go either way. Those are the types of things I'm interested in. I think mergers, there's been a lot of mergers in healthcare in the provider side, that is in the hospital side, as well as now people haven't paid as much attention to, but also in the insurance side. And why, as the stories are always, well, we can do better. We could do better if we have a unified system. The economist in me always says, But that means you're getting closer to monopoly, and monopolies raise prices. So I'm concerned about monopoly power in healthcare.
And what about social media, like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram? How do you think that has affected economics?
I would say probably not very much at all.
What about because of increased forms of communications between, let's say, the stock market and investors, you think it'd change it in some way?
No, why?
I don't know, versus letter mail or telegraphs. I don't really know what they used to forms of communications.
Newsletters, I guess, and email.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no idea, to be honest with you. For me, I look at it all as, are they sources of data? I don't really use that as communication means. With my co-authors, oh gosh, way back in the early days, probably before you were born, this is in the mid-80s, I first started sending a file to a colleague in, this was when I was in Texas, sending this file to somebody in Massachusetts over the BitNet system, which was, there were two systems. One was the BitNet system, one was the internet system. And I used the BitNet system originally. And that was just sending files back and forth. That was really before there was Windows or anything like it, you know. So for me, the computer for me is a work thing.
Yeah.
I use it to communicate with colleagues. I use it to write and revise. I keep drafts of my papers and keep the research materials organized. I use it to access papers published by others, to search on Google for research. Mm-hmm. I use it to send documents back and forth. And I guess the most high-tech thing I probably do, and I don't even do it on my machine, is Skype with other people.
Yeah.
When we can't get together physically, we will use Skype. But in terms of other types of impact on my research, no, none. I don't see how people have the time to do all the kind of stuff that they're constantly doing with that, you know. I mean, I have a Facebook page, but I only check it every once in a while because a lot of my friends and family do post things to it, but I don't really do it myself.
I mean, Facebook nowadays, like, yes, it's used for social networking, but I see it more as a promotional tool to really get your word out of your business or to, like, sort of say whatever promotions you're doing.
I don't have a lot of links. I don't want a lot of stuff coming in. So I'm not sure I would even be accessed or accessible by anybody just randomly.
Yeah.
I get a lot of spam.
Yeah,
and I get a lot of, no, I would say my links are more through LinkedIn or ResearchGate. And even those, although I kind of joined, I don't really mind them, you know, because I'm not interested in looking for another job.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty well linked up with work right now. I'm not particularly interested in finding other linkages. So I think that makes me sound like a cave woman, but... I find it very difficult to get all my work done. I work really pretty hard, and I just can't be distracted by stuff. I don't even have a smartphone.
What? Do you have a flip phone?
I do, but it's always off.
Okay.
It's in my purse. I bought one in case I have a flat tire on the highway somewhere, so I would be able to call. But basically, that's all it's for in my life.
Is it indestructible?
I have no idea. In fact, the embarrassing thing is that my cell phone provider contacted me a couple months ago and said, look, lady, that's not what they said. They said, dear customer, you have to get a new phone because we're not going to be using the 2G network anywhere.
Yeah.
Apparently, my phone was still on the 2G network. I had no idea. So I now have a new phone. But I know it works, but I really haven't figured out how to use it very much.
Is it a smartphone, a flip
phone?
A flip phone?
Yeah. I mean, it opens and closes, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what you mean by that.
Flip phone, yeah.
But it's just to me, you know, I see these students looking at these phones all the time, and I think to myself, what could they possibly be looking at, you know? Twitter feed from some celebrity or something? How can that be interesting? I don't connect. I'm sorry, I don't understand it.
Well, from a professional standpoint, I can definitely see it. Like, I constantly have to check my email, update my LinkedIn, and kind of present myself in a positive light, so, like, for jobs and whatnot.
And you're a freshman?
Yes, I am.
Well, can't you wait till you're a senior to do it?
Not really, because you have to show mastery of digital media if you want internships and whatnot, and you have to show some proof of your work, especially in a journalistic field. You have to show that you know what you're doing.
And that's your field?
Journalism, yes.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, that makes a difference.
Yeah, well, engineers, I'm not sure how you'd show your work. Maybe an engineering project of some sort?
Yeah, well, probably.
Yeah. But
I mean, what comes over your smartphone that's so important for you to read on a regular basis?
Personally, I don't really use, like, social media, just for promotional materials, but I just get 50,000 emails a day, and I always have to check it.
From whom?
From clubs, networks, jobs, pretty much every source imaginable I get an email from.
It sounds like a lot of spam to me.
It's actually not. You'd be surprised. But with people who check their, it's like, Twitter for celebrity tweets, I can sort of see the appeal to kind of get lost in your own life to see what beef is going on between two celebrities, like who slapped who did what, who or what. It's kind of nice to relax and kind of numb
not
the brain.
Not in the middle of class.
Not in the middle of class. I'm not agreeing with you. Yeah.
And I also have to say, college is the one time when you're really going to have the freedom to pursue intellectual interests mm-hmm. in an organized way. You know, it's the only time that it's going to be possible, maybe, or easy to take art or the Russian novel or the history of China mm-hmm. and to read about it. You know, why you'd care whether Jennifer Lopez slapped her boyfriend or not when you could be doing things mm-hmm. that are so much more interesting and so much more valuable to you as a human being. Yeah. I find the preoccupation, oh, I'm going to get in so much trouble. I find it trivial and light without substance okay. for the most part.
I mean, it's just a form of entertainment, like a video game. Some people really enjoy following these people and seeing what they're up to.
I know, but you got to contain your recreation to a few small parts
yeah,
of the day
I
when
agree
you're
with
at
you.
College.
Yeah, it's not okay, like, even in the middle of your studies to kind of goof off, but that's what people do because it's so easy to do now.
Maybe that's the problem. I wonder how many people could handle it if they left their smartphone at home in the morning.
I would say 20% could handle it, if I had to guess. If you took a sample of 100 students, 20 could probably handle it.
And my guess would be that you would have a far more productive day.
That's also true. But what about the people who have work on their phones like me? I have a bunch of books from the Gutenberg Project, assignments and whatnot, and texts from other people to communicate. What about those people who actually use it for productivity?
Well, that is, in fact, I mean, I think the problem mm-hmm. is that you really do use it for your work. But then the problem is it's too easy to flip over into Angry mm-hmm. Birds or something like that. I personally had to, so this is really going to date me. Do you know what Tetris is?
I love Tetris. It's my favorite game of all time.
I had to take it off my machine and not only remove the icon, mm-hmm. I said to the tech person, I said, remove the files, erase the files from my hard drive. I cannot have that on
Tetris?
My machine. Tetris.
What, your computer or?
Tetris, and then FreeCell. In fact, I said to her, no games, take them all off. All of the games. So there's no icon, there's no files. I mean, I know it's probably possible for me to go online and just download them all, but I do not because I can't control it. So I know that I would spend way too much time playing Tetris
FreeCell.
And FreeCell. So I do not have them on my machine.
We're talking about your computer, correct?
My machine. Yeah, my computer,
okay.
Right.
But you would FreeCell, the most boring game of all time?
Yeah, well.
Like Tetris, I can understand. It's awesome. You got your blocks and you got to put them together.
It's a matter of taste. I like them both. And I just have them both gone from my machine.
Don't you miss Tetris?
I miss it, but that means I should keep it off my machine because I need to work.
What if you want to play Tetris?
Well, you know what? Working is hard. Hmm. And it's hard to write those lectures, and it's hard to grade those exams, and it's hard to write those research papers. And it would be way too easy for me to say, I'm just going to play a couple games of Tetris, and half an hour later, mm-hmm. Have lost a half an hour where I should have been working on some of my work. So I just say, no games on my computer.
Then what do you do when you want to relax after all this work?
I go home. Oh, you mean what do I do to relax?
Yeah.
I read a lot and I watch TV probably and I cook.
There we go. TV. It's a form of escape.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So is reading.
Yeah. Well, reading requires a lot of work, which I know millennials do not want to put in.
Reading requires a lot of work?
Like leisure reading. You can probably, a lot of people do not read anymore for leisure, and I do not approve of that, but that's just the way it is. It's a lot easier. Yeah, it's a lot easier to just go on YouTube and just see whatever is on YouTube.
I know, but it's too easy to forget everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that it's kind of like music.
Yeah.
It uses a different part of your brain. Reading a really good novel, I think, is so engrossing. When I'm really reading a good novel, I look forward every day to going home and sitting down and having a chance to read some more of it. And that means it's a long one. That's a big commitment, right? But it can make your life just so much better. It's like, I'm looking forward to reading again.
You are listening to Prof Talks, only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
What's the last book you've read, and do you read popular books like Game of Thrones?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
in fact,
just checking.
I read a lot of what I've been into most recently is more science fiction and fantasy. As a matter
really?
Of fact, I have the first book of Game of Thrones.
Ooh.
The problem is, it's just so intimidating to think about reading the whole series.
Oh, don't. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm halfway through the first book. No spoilers. Awesome.
Well, maybe I'll get around to it. The last book I read, I went through a thing of rereading. What's the last book I read? I did read, and this was for work, and it was a huge book, so it took me a while. Ben Bernanke's book.
Which
Professor
was?
Highclack gave me this, The Courage to Act, about being the head of the Fed during the whole crisis.
What?
It was very interesting, actually. But that was the last really substantial book. I've read something else since then, but I'm trying to remember what it was. My memory is fading with my age, I'm afraid. But no, I read a lot of mysteries at some points, science fiction at other points. I'm more science fiction than fantasy, but I've also done a fair amount of fantasy this way, that way.
Favorite book?
I don't have one.
Really? I can tell you right now, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, I thought that was so boring.
It was awesome. What are you talking about?
No, that did not appeal to me. I read it and I was like, why do people
Did you
rave?
Read only one of the books or all of them?
I think at least one. I was totally untempted.
It was awesome.
Well, see, it's a matter of taste. So many people raved about Dune, and I could not understand the appeal of that one either.
It says the meaning of life. It's all about science fiction and randomness and space. It's awesome.
Yeah, well, matter of taste.
Okay. This is a great point to come back to economics. Do other countries affect us more than they did years ago?
Oh, I would say yes, for two reasons. One is that we're more open to international trade than we used to be. I don't know the numbers. But the U.S. used to be, way back in the 60s, for instance, maybe imports and exports, if you thought about the flows, maybe 10% of GDP. My guess is it's bigger now. So just in terms of trade, goods and services going back and forth, I think probably that represents a larger segment of, so we have more exports and more imports. But more importantly, as the world has gotten richer, I don't know, I'm not sure I know what I'm talking about here, but as the world has gotten richer, people have saved more, they have more capital. And as capital markets have opened up around the world, a lot more capital flows back and forth in different, in and out of different countries. And the U.S. is a big destination for capital. Mm-hmm. People like to buy U.S. bonds, they think it's relatively safe. So people in U.S. buy them, but also people and governments in the rest of the world buy them too. So a lot of capital's going in, and also U.S. is investing elsewhere as well. So the capital flows, I think, are much more substantial. Though I'm not an expert in international finance, I have to say immediately. Yep. My guess would be that has been that has radically changed, and it does make us more connected, because the financial crash in the U.S. Spread partly because some of those mortgage-backed bonds, many of them were bought by people in the rest of the world, and so when the U.S. system crashed and those bonds started to lose value, people around the world were holding bonds that were losing value, as far as I understand it. So, you know, when China starts growing slower, it affects Australia, it affects Brazil, it affects all of South America, and it affects us too. When India, if India starts growing, that will probably affect us. Where I think the whole world is more interconnected than it used to be.
Why?
Well, because we have moved to more trade. And we've seen, you know, it has greatly increased the living standard of a lot of people in China and India in particular. You know, 500 million people have been lifted out of poverty or something along those lines. It's been remarkable. But that really has been because we've allowed these trades in goods and services and capital, I think. And it's certainly not without its costs.
And do you think there'll be some radical shift in power anytime in the future?
You'll have to be more specific.
We see this balance of trade between countries. Do you think one country in particular will get very powerful in some way, or no?
Well, the whole point of trade is that both parties benefit, right? If you sell something to me, I want to buy it. So you take money and I take the good or service, right? And we both walk away happy. So the idea of trade making one country more powerful than the other, so you start going off into these ideas of countries only exporting and not importing, right? And some people seem to think that's a good idea. And then you say, but that means you're sending, you know, all of your TVs away. For what?
Money.
Well, but they can only give you their currency, right? I mean, we haven't studied this in ECO 1 yet, but trade is supposed to benefit both sides. It helps if you don't run up a trade deficit all the time, because that means you're borrowing from the rest of the world to cover it. And the U.S. has particular power to do that because the dollar is what they call a reserve currency. A lot of things are denominated in dollars around the world. But for other countries, smaller countries, they can't really do that for very long. In the overall stance, you don't necessarily want to be balanced with each country. You just want to be balanced overall, right? Mm-hmm. So you may run a persistent deficit with one country and a persistent surplus with another. But so long as overall or over time, you're kind of more balanced. From year to year, you don't necessarily want to force balance on any particular relationship. Same with the deficit. The latest thing I heard, I don't know which politician said this, but to say that the federal government should balance its budget every year is not a good idea. It's a bad idea. But there's been a lot of kind of primitive economics being flung around by a lot of people, and it's scary to listen to this stuff. Because you think to yourself, well, geez, what would happen if they actually balanced the federal budget and we had a recession? That would mean you would cut what? You would cut Social Security payments and unemployment insurance and make the recession worse. I mean, it's just not, it's depressing is what it is.
Okay, and what is the status of the U.S. currently? Are we in a recession? Are we in late recovery? And is it good?
Well, I think we are in, we're in late recovery. We're not in recession anymore, I would say, because our employment has really recovered. So to some extent, things are pretty decent. More and more people are employed, and particularly the last 3 months, we've seen an increase in the labor participation rate, which is a good sign, because that means you have more workers working, more of a labor force. Yeah. The problems are that the rest of the world is kind of fragile, and our interest rates are still pretty low, so it would be it's a concern whether, you know, a nasty shock from the rest of the world could push us back into recession, which would not be good. So far, the U.S. economy seems to be shaking off those those influences, but it's a concern. And the fact that monetary policy really is not particularly effective right now, and that's our main weapon, right, is not particularly effective right now. And fiscal policy is difficult because Congress doesn't want to spend anything that adds to the debt. So we don't have a lot of weapons to combat any immediate problems, or our weapons are not great to combat immediate problems that we might have. I think more people are starting to be more concerned about the longer term, about productivity growth. Investment by U.S. firms has been anemic. It's not been good. And we need investment because workers are more productive when they have more capital to work with, and that means they get better wages. So better wages are tied to more capital per worker, more productive workers. So that's a concern. And I think even longer term, dealing with issues of the inequality is really important. How do you make sure that people have real options for earning a decent standard of living? And I think the U.S. has to think more deeply and more creatively about that type of problem. The minimum wage, you know, maybe that can be part of the answer, but that's not one I would want to hang my hat on. I would think they would work harder to think more creatively about different ways to address these problems. I think the kind of basic two problems that I would worry about most going forward are productivity growth and inequality.
And how can we make sure these aren't reoccurring problems?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure we've ever solved them exactly. We used to have a less unequal distribution of income. There's been a lot of study about the different reasons that it has become so much more unequal. Some of those we may be able to address, some of them we may have to think of new ideas. The productivity one is a real question. I mean, some people are saying, oh, we've kind of run out of new ideas, that either we need to spend more money on research and development, or even if we do, we won't have any new ideas. So that seems particularly pessimistic, and I hope that's not true. Particularly in biology, you think there's going to be a lot of new ideas there and potentially new technologies. But there's also the idea of, have we really been able to harness information technology yet in a way that changed the world to match the way that harnessing electricity changed the world? You know, the internet and information technology and computers have changed the world, but have they had the impact that electricity did? I think a lot of people would say no, not in terms of the fundamental changes to human well-being. But, you know, it's possible that they still, that we just need to figure out better how to use them or how to integrate them into our world to improve our lives. I don't know. Hopefully they can increase productivity growth, because productivity growth is an important key to better standard of living for everybody.
I don't know. I would argue that the internet has a greater impact than electricity, because it impacted everything. Computers, now we can send files everywhere. We have this whole unlimited digital space of content. So in that sense, yeah, I want to say the internet is more impactful than electricity.
No, not if you think about it hard. Electricity, if you didn't have electricity, you couldn't even have the information.
Yeah.
in the internet. If you lose your power,
you can use candles
for any length of time. It's not going to keep your food cold or cook your coffee or, you know, run your radio. I don't know if you know what a radio is.
Well, this is for a radio station, so I'd hope so.
I have a radio where you have a crank.
A crank radio?
So when the power went out because of Katrina, I cranked my radio up and I listened. I was actually very lucky in Katrina, because I only lost my power for like 12 or 14 hours.
I lost for a couple days.
No, I did not. I have to say that I took in another faculty member who did lose their power for almost a week.
Ooh, it's not good.
And the people across the street lost their power for almost a week. But my side of the street was very lucky. But you don't have to lose your power very long before you understand how important electricity is. I can live without digital media. I can't live without electricity.
You are listening to Prof Talks, only on WLVR Bethlehem, 91.3 FM.
Lights on, you can use candles, but all those books and everything, all this information is now on the internet. The world has become smaller because the internet has just allowed for this easy connectivity between
people.
Yeah, but
you can't connect if the electricity's not on.
I'm not saying the electricity isn't essential, but I'm just saying the internet has an equal impact to electricity.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Everything you touch in your life that changed the whole way of living, I don't know, maybe it affected women more, but the fact that you don't have to pump water or carry it or hand wash or hang things out and take them off the drying line, that you don't have to cook over a fire anymore. Mm-hmm. All of these things, they turned you from a cave person into a modern person, and that's all electricity.
Okay, we will revisit this argument later.
Okay.
But for now, I just want to ask, how do you make economics more appealing to a younger generation? Because, again, millennials, we don't really have time or lack the ability to sit down and read an economics book. How do you think we can make economics more appealing to my generation?
My first reaction to that is not going to go over well. If you don't have the mental discipline to sit down and read a book, you're really going to be at a major disadvantage in life.
Well, I mean, it's all about micromedia now. It's speed, fast, fast, fast. So I'm not saying every member of our generation can't sit down and read a book. Most do. But I'm just saying, how do you think we can make it more appealing to a younger audience?
I'm not sure it's possible to make a hard thing easy. It's just hard. You know, calculus, you have to sit down and grind away at it. Mm-hmm. Economics, you have to sit down and learn. There's not an easy way necessarily to learn hard things. A Russian novel, you have to sit down and read it. There's Cliff Notes just doesn't do the job. And to say it has to be fast, 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 that just means you're going to miss out. You won't be able to do it. That sounds hard.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some way to sugarcoat it or make it easy, but if you can't sit down and kind of really grapple with hard ideas and sit there and think hard about it and learn, I mean, you may forget everything, but the lasting gift of going to college is exercising your brain and learning how to learn deeply about a particular topic. And you know, you should be able to take those skills wherever you go. So, I don't know. I hope that you take the time to learn how to sit down and learn something that is not quick, quick, flash, flash on a Twitter. I mean, a Twitter feed is not going to help you learn the intricacies of...
It could if you're creative enough.
Really?
Yeah. Just a quick, fast-back economics. Daily economics tweet.
Oh, well, I'm sure such things exist, but how useful are you? I mean, that's the thing. Joe Politician says, we'll go back on the gold standard, or we'll balance the budget. That's the Twitter feed.
Yeah.
And if you haven't done the hard work of learning an aggregate supply, aggregate demand model, you won't know how nonsensical those statements are. All you'll have is that shallow Twitter feed. You have to learn the substance. You have to learn the models. It's not easy. There is no easy way to do it, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to sit down and learn it. Not a good message. I could tell.
That's fair. That's fair.
I could tell.
No,
they're going to be turning off this prop feed right at this point. No. I don't want to hear this. But I'm sorry. That's the fact.
I mean, that's fair. Like, you gave a great answer, and I can respect that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how is an American economy different from, let's say, China's economy?
Well, ours is, we're wealthier,
yeah,
right, on a per capita basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, people say, well, the size of the GDP is almost the same, but if you divide by the number of people, we have a lot more GDP per person. So we're wealthier, and we currently have a lot more capital per worker, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm not an expert on the Chinese economy.
Yeah.
You know, they're developing, and I know it's scary for people, but the great thing is, think of all those minds over there working, you know, and hopefully trying to come up with new technologies and hopefully somebody will cure cancer or come up with great ideas. There's going to be, you know, a handful of really fabulous universities may already be in China with lots of really smart people working hard to solve problems. And that's what I think we're going to need. We always need people, smart people working really hard to solve hard problems because there's a lot of hard problems to solve.
Yeah.
So that is a hopeful sign that their economy is growing, that they're investing in schools, and a lot of more people are getting educated and starting to, you know, really try to solve these problems. They have a lot of pollution problems. We're much further along in controlling our pollution. They have a lot of pollution problems. Hopefully they can work hard on figuring out how to solve some of them so that India, which is going to be right behind them, burning a lot of coal, unfortunately, maybe they can get some technologies from us that maybe the Chinese will work really hard and get some better technologies. I mean, hopefully they, you know, we don't all have to solve all the problems. Hopefully other people can solve some of the problems and we can get the advantage of that, right? Because once the knowledge is created, a lot of times you could take advantage of it, you know, unless it's patented and they can get you there. But
yeah, it's true.
Even so.
You can kind of like extrapolate from the patent.
Well, sometimes yes and sometimes no, but patents aren't forever.
Do you have any advice for young economists getting into the field?
For undergraduates that are economics majors?
Yes.
I think the most important thing is to really consider what most attracts you, what kinds of questions you want to answer, what kind of things do you see or would you like to see yourself doing over the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah.
If you really want to study and do research in macroeconomics, for instance, I would say you need to take math, unfortunately. You need to take math. If you want to work with health data to study, you know, the economics of health and healthcare, you need to take math and statistics as well as economics. And the economics goes without saying.
Yeah.
If you want to go to law school, I would say you need to get the you need to take the economics classes. Maybe a little statistics would come in handy, but I would also combine it with political science and history, and work hard on your writing skills. If you want to go into political science, I'd say all three same thing.
Yeah.
So the basic economic reasoning you can get from the field classes, the labor, the industrial organization, urban, those types of classes that study particular areas are the macro. If you want to do research in those areas, you need to tool up in math and statistics to go to graduate school.
Yeah.
Or even to go to consulting. Though I would say also if you're thinking consulting, it would be a really good idea to take classes where you have to write. Mm. So maybe history classes. I'm not sure which classes require people to actually write a lot.
Probably English.
Maybe. Reading is also very good for learning how to write well. Classes where you have to read and write, that will stand you in good stead. Aside from working on those skills, it also expands your knowledge of the human condition, which can't be, which is a good thing. It's better to have those internal resources because life can be hard.
Can be indeed. And anything you'd like to add or anything you wish I'd asked that I didn't?
About economics, I probably talk too much about economics in areas on which I'm only vaguely familiar. About studying economics, you know, some people just really are attracted to it and they just love it. Mm-hmm. Other people, not so much, but I still think it's a useful thing to understand how economists approach problems. Mm-hmm. Because you may say, I want to counter the argument. It's easier if you understand
you've
what
been
the
listening to Prof
be
Talk.
In the first place.
To hear all the interviews and check out extended material, log
thank
on to our archive,
time.
WLVR.
You just listened to Prof Talks on WLVR, probably online, but you don't know. with Mary Beth Diley. Again, I appreciate your time and everything, and I hope to see you again soon.
All right.